The following audiobook contains AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Paper Wealth, Real Estate, How AI Equity Fuels San Francisco Bidding Wars. Topic Introduction. On a quiet afternoon in San Francisco, the front door of a hilltop home stands open to the street. Sunlight slides across wide plank floors, catches the edge of a stone fireplace, and settles for a moment on a view that seems almost too orderly to be real. From the sidewalk, the house looks like a prize. Inside, it feels more like a test. A listing above $3 million has drawn a steady stream of visitors, each one moving a little more carefully than usual. Each one listening for the same hidden question: what exactly can they afford to do when the bidding starts? The people at the open house are not all there for the same reason. One couple has already sold a home and wants something bigger, closer to the city's old money neighborhoods. A listing agent watches their faces with practiced calm, knowing that emotion often matters less than speed and certainty. A buyer's agent stands near the kitchen, phone in hand, ready to translate a client's confidence into something a seller will trust. And somewhere in the city, a young employee at an artificial intelligence company is looking at the same kind of house with a very different feeling. Not fantasy, but possibility. The down payment might come from a salary, yes, but more likely from something less visible and more volatile. A slice of private company equity that has quietly grown into real purchasing power. That is where this story begins. In the narrow space between a home that exists in the physical world and wealth that may still exist mostly on paper. In the Bay Area, the difference matters. A salary is straightforward. Paper wealth is the value of stock holdings that may rise sharply inside a private company before anyone can readily sell them. Liquid cash is the money that can be wired into escrow, cleared, and used to make an offer next week. In a market like San Francisco's, those three things do not behave the same way at all. The city's housing market in 2026 sits at the crossroads of two powerful forces. One is the familiar scarcity of homes in a place that has long struggled to add enough of them. The other is a newer kind of wealth, tied to artificial intelligence companies, venture capital, and the mechanisms that let employees turn private equity into spendable money before an initial public offering ever arrives. That transformation can happen through stock options, which give an employee the right to buy shares at a set price, or through restricted stock units, often called RSUs, which are shares that vest over time as employment continues. It can also happen through secondary sales, where employees sell vested shares to outside investors, or through tender offers, where a company creates a window for workers to cash out part of their holdings. Those terms sound technical, but their effect is simple enough. They change timing. They change who can move quickly. And in housing, timing is everything. A bidding war in San Francisco does not begin with a single offer. It begins days or weeks earlier, when a home is photographed, staged, and promoted to the right audience. It moves through disclosure packets, those thick bundles of documents that can run for hundreds of pages, and into a compressed offer period that rewards people who can act without hesitation. Some buyers ask whether a foundation report, a past permit, or a slope condition should worry them. Others are already thinking about contingencies, the escape hatches that can make a contract safer for the buyer but less appealing to the seller. In this market, even the language of the deal feels like a contest between caution and speed. This audiobook explores why that contest has become so intense. It asks, What happens when a region full of engineers, founders, and employees receives an unexpected surge of liquidity, and that money heads straight for a housing market that has spent decades limiting how many homes it can add? San Francisco is not simply expensive by accident. It is shaped by underbuilding, the gap between the number of homes people need and the number actually available. It is shaped by zoning rules, height limits, neighborhood resistance, and a geography that leaves little room to grow outward. It is shaped by permitting systems that can stretch projects across years, not months. And it is shaped by a very modern contradiction: an economy that creates wealth quickly and a housing supply that cannot respond anywhere near as fast. For listeners, the question is not just why prices are high. It is why certain buyers can move with such force. Why a home priced at the edge of reach suddenly becomes a magnet for people who are not borrowing in the usual way. And why the market seems to translate private company success into neighborhood pressure so efficiently. The answer runs through the open houses, but it does not stop there. It passes through cap tables, equity grants, secondary transactions, mortgage rates, construction limits, and the stubborn reality that a city cannot absorb new demand unless it has somewhere for that demand to go. San Francisco becomes, in this story, more than a luxury market. It becomes a lens. Through it, one can see the collision between speculative wealth and physical scarcity, between paper value and real-world shelter, between a fast-moving tech economy and the slow work of building homes. The result is not just a price chart. It is a portrait of how modern fortunes take shape, where they land, and what they do when they arrive all at once. What follows is a close look at that collision, from the polished calm of a high-end open house to the structural forces that make the cities so hard to build in and so easy to bid up. By the time the final offer is written, the true story will have already begun much earlier, in the way wealth is created, timed, and released into a market that has very little room to absorb it. End of introduction. Redfin's 2026 home value reporting for the San Francisco metro and city, along with Case-Shiller data for the San Francisco metropolitan area from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, frame the pricing backdrop. In that context, imagine standing on a quiet afternoon in a hilltop neighborhood of San Francisco, perhaps Pacific Heights or Noe Valley, where a freshly painted Edwardian facade or a sharp-edged contemporary home sits under pale Northern California light. The brochure price is above $3 million. For many buyers, that number reads like a finish line. For the people actually bidding, it starts to function more like an entrance fee. Across the prior year, the San Francisco metro has posted home value growth around 11%, with prices inside the city up roughly 15%, far beyond the national pace of about 2%. In that setting, a listing at this level quickly stops feeling like an offer and starts feeling like a deadline, waiting to be answered. Inside, the mood stays hushed and controlled. Prospective buyers move slowly across wide plank floors, leaning in toward stonework and windows, sometimes pausing at the view line where the Golden Gate Bridge sits like a fixed reference point for the decision. What looks like a refined weekend ritual is also the first step in a tightly sequenced, high-stakes transaction. Weeks earlier, the listing begins as marketing, not bargaining. Professional photography, curated digital galleries, and in many cases, private showings for the people the seller expects to convert. Once the public open house closes, the deal enters its most compressed phase. Buyers and their advisors request disclosure packets that can run to hundreds of pages. Those documents may include geological reports, records related to structural conditions, and documentation tied to past neighborhood permitting. Then comes the offer deadline, often set within days, giving the market a schedule it cannot ignore. Waiting becomes the risk that lets a competitor get ahead. Sellers evaluate incoming offers with more than a single yardstick. Yes, higher price matters, but speed and certainty determine how likely the transaction is to survive until closing, because the downside of failure is concrete. A stalled deal means time lost and a home that returns to market with a story the next buyer can feel. At the top end, contract terms, especially waivers of contingencies, often carry as much weight as the final figure, since a slightly lower offer with fewer ways to fall apart can feel more valuable than a higher bid that might not clear. Real estate agents and brokers translate that risk and momentum into signals that buyers pick up quickly. A listing agent may point to how many people are requesting disclosures, how quickly second showings are being scheduled, and whether multiple parties are actively preparing offers at the same time. Buyers' agents translate those cues into strategy, structuring the bid so it passes the seller's filters and doing it fast enough to stay in the running. In practice, that can mean waiving inspection or financing contingencies, shifting uncertainty onto the buyer instead of the seller. The buyers who can repeatedly survive that bondlet tend to come from a specific part of the modern economy. The market still includes corporate executives and long-established families, but the high-end edge is increasingly shaped by people whose wealth is tied to technology, and more specifically, to AI. Their purchasing power does not arrive primarily through a paycheck. It arrives through changes in the value of equity held in private companies, wealth that can expand on paper and then, once liquidity paths exist, turn into usable money. To understand why that distinction matters, it helps to separate three measures. There is annual salary. There is paper net worth, which reflects the value of holdings in private startups. And there is liquid cash, the money that can be wired into escrow within a short time frame and actually clear the steps required to make an offer. A high salary can look strong on a tax return and still fall short at this level, especially when competing bids arrive with cash-ready terms. Paper net worth can look enormous on a spreadsheet and still be unusable when it is trapped inside shares that cannot be readily sold to the public. In the Bay Area, the upstream source of that kind of equity-driven liquidity sits far from the open house itself. It sits in global venture capital flows into AI companies, with a disproportionate share in landing in the region. Venture capital investment in Bay Area AI companies was on track to reach approximately $79.2 billion by the end of 2024. Around 27% higher than the prior year. That funding is not evenly distributed across the map. It clusters around companies headquartered in and around San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and then clusters again when those companies award equity to employees. OpenAI, Anthropic, Databricks, Scale AI, and CoreWeave are among the firms often associated with that concentration of private company growth. As these companies scale, their valuations rise dramatically while they remain private longer than earlier tech eras sometimes did. By 2025, AI startups attracted approximately 53% of all global venture capital dollars. The effect extends beyond company balance sheets because it builds a larger pool of employees whose shares, options, or restricted stock units can move from theoretical value to realized value once liquidity mechanisms become available. That transition starts with how compensation works. Stock options give an employee the right to buy a specific number of shares at a predetermined strike price, usually set when the employee joins. If later rounds place a much higher valuation on the company, the market value implied by those options can rise far above the strike price, creating large unrealized gains. Restricted stock units, or RSUs, represent a grant of shares that vest over time, typically contingent on continued employment and the company's ongoing conditions. In both cases, the employee's wealth tracks the company's private valuation trajectory. Still, paper wealth stays paper wealth until a real transaction occurs. A private valuation can be anchored by funding rounds and investor agreements, but it is not automatically spendable. It reflects what one class of investors is willing to pay for a slice of a company, not what can be wired into an account for a down payment next week. For years, employees often had to wait for an initial public offering to cash out, and that wait could stretch for a long time. What changes in the current environment is the availability of channels that let employees monetize earlier, without waiting for public markets to open. One such channel is the secondary share sale. In a private secondary transaction, an employee sells a portion of vested shares to institutional investors or specialized secondary funds. The buyer gains exposure to a high-growth private company without needing an IPO, and the seller receives cash without waiting for public markets to reopen. Another mechanism is a company-sponsored tender offer. In a tender offer, the company coordinates a window in which eligible employees can sell a portion of their holdings back to the company or to approved external investors at a set valuation. These paths matter because they change timing. In earlier cycles, liquidity tended to arrive later, clustering around public listings. In the current cycle, liquidity can arrive sooner and in larger batches, especially in hot sectors where investor demand for exposure persists, even while companies remain private. In early April of 2026, Anthropic concluded an employee tender offer priced at a pre-money valuation of $350 billion. Reporting described a split outcome, with some employees taking cash and many choosing to keep their exposure for potential future events, such as an IPO. Either way, the program created a pool of newly liquid capital among employees eligible to participate. For employees who want cash while keeping upside, share-backed lending has also become more common. Under this approach, a worker borrows money using private stock as collateral, making it possible to access liquidity without requiring the same kind of immediate sale as a straightforward equity monetization. Exercising stock options is another route, but it can demand upfront cash for the strike price and may trigger tax liabilities. So the spread between the strike price and the company's current valuation can significantly affect how much of the paper gain becomes spendable cash. Once monetized equity is in hand, housing is often the most visible and immediate destination. Newly liquid capital can take the form of a large down payment, an all-cash offer, or a highly competitive proof-of-funds posture that reduces seller uncertainty. In that environment, broader mortgage conditions have less leverage over the people driving the bids. Nationally, average 30-year fixed mortgage rates have sat around 6.4% in recent months, which tends to slow buyers who need to borrow. But for buyers who can bypass traditional mortgage financing, the rate becomes more of a background variable than a binding constraint. This is general information, not financial advice. The other advantage is time. Short offer windows reward buyers who can act quickly, assemble paperwork, and commit without waiting for lender approvals. when bidding compresses what can normally take months into something that takes days, offers compete not only on price, but on certainty and execution. The bidding war at the top end becomes a collision between two systems: equity liquidity mechanisms tied to AI venture and private company valuation on one side, and a housing market whose supply remains constrained by decades of physical limits and political friction on the other. The result is that sudden liquidity hits a shortage, turning faster, sharper bids into a price signal that can spread outward. That is where the housing system itself comes into view, because the liquidity still has to meet a market that can barely add homes fast enough. San Francisco's housing inventory reports for 2024 and later, along with Redfin's mid-2026 home value reporting, and the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index data from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, frame the supply backdrop for what happens when new wealth meets limited housing capacity. Understanding the collision between that sudden buying power and physical residential spaces starts with the housing market's basic accounting. Underbuilding is the gap between the number of households seeking homes and the housing supply available to absorb them. It is a structural deficit, not a temporary mismatch that disappears once buyers get a boost. For decades, San Francisco has added too few homes to keep pace with job growth, income growth, and persistent regional demand. As the metro has strengthened its role as a center for technological innovation, high-wage employment has expanded faster than residential construction. That divergence leaves the market with less slack than it would otherwise have. When liquidity arrives quickly, it has fewer places to land besides the existing inventory of homes. So prices respond first, and construction cannot respond at the same speed. A major reason that supply stays tight lies in land use rules, especially zoning and density limits. In parts of San Francisco, municipal codes restrict what can be built on valuable land, often limiting development to single-family homes or low-density structures. Even when demand and land values would support more homes, these restrictions reduce the number of units that can be created from the same site. The outcome is a pattern of development that emphasizes fewer, larger, and more expensive homes rather than a higher volume of options at a wider range of prices. Vertical constraints add another layer. Strict height limits can cap how many units can be added, even when a site looks well-positioned for denser housing near employment centers or transit. When a project cannot scale upward, it creates an artificial ceiling on how much capacity the city can add on its best-connected parcels. In practice, that keeps the physical footprint of the city from adjusting quickly to changing demand. Those regulatory limits then meet neighborhood resistance, which can shape what approvals actually look like on the ground. Existing homeowners and neighborhood groups often press for policies aimed at preserving neighborhood character, managing congestion, or protecting property values. In the local political process, those preferences can translate into pressure that influences planning decisions and the fate of individual projects. When that influence slows approvals or changes project designs, it tightens the supply pipeline in real time. San Francisco also relies heavily on discretionary review for many projects, rather than approvals that run automatically when basic zoning standards are met. Discretionary processes tend to introduce more opportunities for case-by-case evaluation, along with formal appeals. A housing proposal can face multiple public forums, each of which may demand design changes, additional environmental studies, or reductions in unit counts. The practical effect is less predictability and more time spent before a project can become truly buildable. That time shows up as permitting lag. permitting lag is the duration from initial submission to buildable approval, and in the Bay Area, it is measured in years rather than months. During that period, developers carry costs for land acquisition, design work, and professional services, even as market conditions shift. If interest rates rise or construction costs increase, the same project can become harder to finance. In this way, the waiting itself can act like a tax that discourages smaller builders and narrows who can carry projects through uncertainty. The scale of the gap between proposed and delivered housing is visible in official housing inventory reports. These registries can show a multi-year pipeline of proposed units at various stages of review. On paper, a pipeline can signal future abundance, but the pipeline also highlights a critical economic difference. An approved project is not the same thing as a completed home. To move from approval to occupancy, a developer must secure construction financing, assemble labor and materials, and continue through fluctuating market conditions. When rates rise or costs spike, some developments stop moving forward and remain shelved. That is why the region ends up with persistent shortages, even when planning folders look busy. Only a fraction of proposed units become move-in-ready homes, and the shortfall matters most when demand surges. For buyers with sudden liquidity-ready funds, the lack of substitutes can feel immediate. If a buyer loses one property, there may not be an equivalent alternative down the street because the surrounding inventory did not expand quickly enough to absorb higher demand. Bay Area geography reinforces the same pattern. The peninsula is bounded by water on three sides, which limits outward expansion in the way that flat, inland regions can sometimes use suburban growth to add capacity. In San Francisco, new homes must come through infill construction or redevelopment on land that is already developed and already contested. That makes every additional unit harder to secure, and it tends to keep political and financial complexity higher than it would be in places with easier access to undeveloped land. When geography and regulation combine, the supply curve becomes highly inelastic, meaning it does not move much, even when demand changes. In a responsive housing market, a wave of job creation and higher incomes can trigger a boom in construction within a few years. Here, physical and administrative bottlenecks prevent that responsiveness. The result is a structural deficit of homes that persists through cycles, even as demand and wealth move through the region. The consequences of that inelasticity show up clearly when affluent buyers enter the market at the same time. If liquidity rises for some buyers and the available inventory stays fixed, bargaining shifts towards sellers. A buyer who can move quickly still faces the same underlying constraint, and the scarcity of comparable alternatives increases sellers' leverage. In this environment, sellers can demand stronger terms, including risk-shifting practices that reduce the chance of reversal after an offer is made, because there are not many equivalent homes for the buyer to switch to. This local dynamic becomes sharper when compared with national patterns. In May of 2026, public real estate registries showed a national baseline of home prices up about 2% year over year, with a median sale price just under $400,000. Mortgage rates stayed elevated, and the average 30-year fixed mortgage rate hovered around 6.4% in May, which kept borrowing costs high for many households. Existing home sales rose about 5.2% year over year, and the inventory of homes for sale increased only modestly, by roughly 0.7%. Nationally, roughly one quarter of homes sold above their list price during that period, which reflects continued competitiveness, but also a market that is not tightening in the same dramatic way everywhere. the intensity of the supply squeeze in most of the country is still meaningful, yet it is less concentrated than what shows up in Northern California. As a result, the national market does not produce the same kind of near-term displacement toward the luxury tier when new capital arrives. Within the same period, San Francisco's divergence is what people tend to feel first. Metro home values rose by around 11% year over year, far above the national baseline, and prices inside the city rose by roughly 15%. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index for the San Francisco metropolitan area also continued upward, reaching about 361.2 in December of 2025, and staying on an elevated trajectory consistent with peak price territory. These indices summarize market levels, not the buyer financing path behind each purchase, but they reinforce the sense that the region is operating at an unusually expensive point in the cycle. Still, price indices cannot show how the buying power got converted into offers. They record the final transaction price, but they do not reveal whether a purchase relied on a conforming mortgage, a jumbo loan, a structured line of credit, or an all-cash transaction. To understand the transmission mechanism, the story needs to connect capital timing to housing constraints. New high-income liquidity, generated by venture finance and private equity monetization, can enter a housing market where supply cannot expand quickly. When thousands of households suddenly compete for a limited number of homes, the added demand has only one short-term direction to move, because construction does not catch up in time. Constrained supply turns new demand into price appreciation. That mechanism also helps explain the contrast buyers notice between affordability pressure and bid readiness. Mortgage rates still matter for many households, particularly those relying on traditional borrowing. A 30-year fixed rate around 6.4% reduces purchasing power for wage-dependent buyers and can delay entry into the market. At the same time, buyers with cash or stock liquidity can bypass part of the usual interest rate channel, which can make the prevailing mortgage environment a background condition rather than the main constraint at the luxury end. The distributional stakes follow from that asymmetry. Existing homeowners benefit when prices climb because their home equity rises with the market. Renters and wage earners face a different reality because higher prices can change rents and make it harder to move up. Even when higher prices do not directly displace anyone on day one, the lack of alternatives can raise the risk of longer-term instability by making it more difficult to find comparable homes in favored neighborhoods. In the end, the current price surge reads less like a normal cycle of supply adjusting to demand and more like a political and geographic bottleneck. In a typical market, rising prices encourage enough additional building to pull supply closer to demand over time. Here, restrictive zoning, discretionary review, and physical boundaries keep construction from catching up at the pace demand can change. That structural deficit places the luxury tier in the spotlight, where sudden wealth has the clearest effect on bidding speed, terms, and the way prices signal outward to surrounding neighborhoods, as the market tries to absorb liquidity without adding many new homes. Redfin's 2026 home value reporting for the San Francisco metro and city, along with the Case-Shiller Index for the San Francisco metropolitan area compiled by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, frames the backdrop for the luxury end of the market. On a quiet afternoon in Pacific Heights or Noe Valley, a freshly painted Ivorian facade or a sharp-edged contemporary home sits under pale Northern California light. The brochure price is above $3 million, For many buyers, that number reads like a finish line. For the people actually bidding, it starts to function more like an entrance fee. Across the prior year, the San Francisco Metro has posted home value growth around 11%, with prices inside the city up roughly 15%, far beyond the national pace of about 2%. At that level, a listing stops feeling like an invitation and starts feeling like a deadline. Inside, the mood stays hushed and controlled. Prospective buyers move slowly across wide plank floors, lean toward stonework and windows, and pause at the view line where the Golden Gate Bridge acts like a fixed reference point for the decision. What looks like a refined weekend ritual is also the first step in a tightly sequenced, high-stakes transaction. Weeks earlier, the listing begins as marketing, not bargaining. It relies on professional photography, curated digital galleries, and often private showings for the people the seller expects to convert. Once the public open house closes, the deal enters its most compressed phase. Buyers and their advisors request disclosure packets that can run to hundreds of pages. Those packets may include geological reports, structural records, and documentation tied to past neighborhood permitting. Then comes the offer deadline, often set within days, which gives the market a schedule it cannot ignore. Sellers evaluate incoming offers with more than one yardstick. Higher price matters, but speed and certainty determine how likely the transaction is to survive until closing. The downside of failure is concrete. A stalled deal means time lost, and a home that returns to market with a story the next buyer can feel. At the top end, contract terms, especially waivers of contingencies, often carry as much weight as the final figure. A slightly lower offer with fewer ways to fall apart can feel more valuable than a higher bid that might not clear. Real estate agents and brokers translate that risk and momentum into signals buyers pick up quickly. A listing agent may point to how many people are requesting disclosures, how quickly second showings are being scheduled, and whether multiple parties are preparing offers at the same time. Buyers' agents turn those cues into strategy. They structure bids so they pass the seller's filters and move fast enough to stay in the running. In practice, that can mean waiving inspection or financing contingencies and shifting uncertainty onto the buyer instead of the seller. The buyers who can repeatedly survive that gauntlet tend to come from a specific part of the modern economy. The market still includes corporate executives and long-established families, but the high-end edge is increasingly shaped by people whose wealth is tied to technology, and more specifically, to AI. Their purchasing power does not arrive primarily through a paycheck. It arrives through changes in the value of equity held in private companies, wealth that can expand on paper and then, once liquidity pads exist, turn into usable money. To understand why that distinction matters, it helps to separate three measures. There is annual salary, there is paper net worth, which reflects the value of holdings in private startups, and there is liquid cash, the money that can be wired into escrow within a short time frame and actually clear the steps required to make an offer. A high salary can look strong on a tax return and still fall short at this level, especially when competing bids arrive with cash-ready terms. Paper net worth can look enormous on a spreadsheet and still be unusable when it is trapped inside shares that cannot be readily sold to the public. In the Bay Area, the upstream source of that kind of equity-driven liquidity sits far from the open house itself. It sits in global venture capital flows into AI companies, with a disproportionate share landing in the region. venture capital investment in Bay Area AI companies was on track to reach approximately $79.2 billion by the end of 2024, around 27% higher than the prior year. That funding is not evenly distributed across the map. It clusters around companies headquartered in and around San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and then clusters again when those companies award equity to employees. OpenAI, Anthropic, Databricks, Scale AI, and CoreWeave are among the firms often associated with that concentration of private company growth. As these companies scale, their valuations rise dramatically while they remain private longer than earlier tech eras sometimes did. By 2025, AI startups attracted approximately 53% of all global venture capital dollars. The effect extends beyond company balance sheets because it builds a larger pool of employees whose shares, options, or restricted stock units can move from theoretical value to realized value once liquidity mechanisms become available. That transition starts with how compensation works. Stock options give an employee the right to buy a specific number of shares at a predetermined strike price, usually set when the employee joins. If later rounds place a much higher valuation on the company, the market value implied by those options can rise far above the strike price, creating large unrealized gains. Restricted stock units, or RSUs, represent a grant of shares that vest over time, typically contingent on continued employment and the company's ongoing conditions. In both cases, the employee's wealth tracks the company's private valuation trajectory. Still, paper wealth stays paper wealth until a real transaction occurs. A private valuation can be anchored by funding rounds and investor agreements, but it is not automatically spendable. It reflects what one class of investors is willing to pay for a slice of a company, not what can be wired into an account for a down payment next week. For years, employees often had to wait for an initial public offering to cash out, and that wait could stretch for a long time. What changes in the current environment is the availability of channels that let employees monetize earlier without waiting for public markets to open. One such channel is the secondary share sale. In a private secondary transaction, an employee sells a portion of vested shares to institutional investors or specialized secondary funds. The buyer gains exposure to a high-growth private company without needing an IPO, and the seller receives cash without waiting for public markets to reopen. Another mechanism is a company-sponsored tender offer. In a tender offer, the company coordinates a window in which eligible employees can sell a portion of their holdings back to the company or to approved external investors at a set valuation. These paths matter because they change timing. In earlier cycles, liquidity tended to arrive later, clustering around public listings. In the current cycle, liquidity can arrive sooner and in larger batches, especially in hot sectors where investor demand for exposure persists, even while companies remain private. In early April of 2026, Anthropic concluded an employee tender offer priced at a pre-money valuation of $350 billion. Reporting described a split outcome, with some employees taking cash and many choosing to keep their exposure for potential future events, such as an IPO. Either way, the program created a pool of newly liquid capital among employees eligible to participate. For employees who want cash while keeping upside, share-backed lending has also become more common. Under this approach, a worker borrows money using private stock as collateral, making it possible to access liquidity without requiring the same kind of immediate sale as a straightforward equity monetization. Exercising stock options is another route, but it can demand upfront cash for the strike price and may trigger tax liabilities. The spread between the strike price and the company's current valuation can therefore affect how much of the paper gain becomes spendable cash. Once monetized equity is in hand, housing is often the most visible and immediate destination. Newly liquid capital can take the form of a large down payment, an all-cash offer, or a highly competitive proof-of-funds posture that reduces seller uncertainty. In that environment, broader mortgage conditions have less leverage over the people driving the bids. Nationally, average 30-year fixed mortgage rates have sat around 6.4% in recent months, which tends to slow buyers who need to borrow. But for buyers who can bypass traditional mortgage financing, the rate becomes more of a background variable than a binding constraint. The other advantage is time. Short offer windows reward buyers who can act quickly, assemble paperwork, and commit without waiting for lender approvals. When bidding compresses what can normally take months into something that takes days, offers compete not only on price but on certainty and execution. The bidding war at the top end becomes a collision between two systems, one built on equity liquidity tied to AI venture and private company valuation, the other on a housing market whose supply remains constrained by decades of physical limits and political friction. The result is that sudden liquidity hits a shortage, turning faster, sharper bids into a price signal that can spread outward. From there, the housing system itself, with underbuilding, zoning, permitting, neighborhood resistance, and physical limits, decides how much of that demand can actually be absorbed. Suggested further reading. If you want to keep checking the housing side evidence as the story changes week to week, Redfin's ongoing housing market reports are a friendly place to start, since they consistently track prices, sales-to-list ratios, inventory, and mortgage rate pressures at both national and metro levels. To ground the supply-can't-easily-respond theme in the Bay Area specifically, seek out the City and Planning Department housing inventory materials for San Francisco, reports that spell out what's actually in the pipeline and how long it tends to take for projects to get permitted and built. For a durable, long-run yardstick of how unusual or not recent price spikes are, use the two major price index families most economists and analysts rely on, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Indices and the FHFA House Price Index. They won't tell you anything about AI millionaires directly, but they make it easier to separate short-term heat from persistent trend. On the AI wealth-to-cash mechanics, how employees turn private stock and options into spendable money before any public market exit, look for equity compensation explainers from specialists such as SECFI. They're built to walk listeners through the practical steps and trade-offs behind options versus RSUs, exercise costs and taxes, secondary sales, tender offers, and share-backed lending. Finally, to connect those individual liquidity events to wider capital market timing, read Ernst & Young's U.S. IPO trend reports for a sense of when big public listings tend to cluster, and pair that with global AI venture overviews like MUFG's AI Weekly Analyses, which summarize how much AI funding is flowing where and how that can foreshadow future waves of private equity wealth. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.